After 8 months of grueling fighting, the Iraqi military has taken the ruined Grand Mosque of al-Nuri. That's in the heart of Mosul, the old city. And it's the biggest city, of course, outside Baghdad in the country's north. The Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi says this signals the end of the fictitious Daesh state, though arguably it has certainly not disappeared from the broader international stage. So what can we reasonably make of this gruelling Battle of Mosul, which Australian counterinsurgency expert David Kilcullen has described as the biggest battle anywhere on this planet this century? As it genuinely reaches its endgame, said to be just days away now, what's left of the IS stronghold, where the caliphate was first formally proclaimed, where a few hundred diehard militants are dug in among civilians, making extensive use of booby traps, suicide bombers and human shields? And what of managing the peace when it comes? Leading military analyst Dr. Anthony Cordesman from Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies, a regular here on Saturday Extra with his insights, joined me earlier and I welcomed him back.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Do you see it as virtually the end?
No, I don't see it as virtually the end, even in Mosul. There was a study published actually yesterday by the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, which is the U.S. military academy, that traced the history of urban warfare where essentially ISIS had been defeated in terms of the major campaign. In every case, it came back, and it came back in terms of attacks and raids over a period of months. Now, whatever happens in Mosul, ISIS retains large elements of its forces, some of them in Iraq, but most of them in Syria. It may have all kinds of small units designed to come back and do raids and attacks, ones that are concealed among the population or infiltrating in from the countryside. And I think that the whole idea that this is in any way a defeat of either ISIS or extremism in the region. First, there are still major elements in Syria. You have other elements in Iraq. ISIS gets much of the media attention, but when you look at the statistics on terrorism, it's only about 11% of the incidents in the Middle East and North Africa region, and it's only about 3.4% of the terrorist incidents that are related to Islamic extremism. So this is important. It will liberate the second largest city in Iraq, at least to the point where most people, most of the time, may be relatively secure. But no, it's not the end of anything.
Why is the liberation of Mosul, why has it been so fraught? I wonder if you believe lessons have been learned there in terms of urban warfare.
Well, I don't know if there have been any lessons of urban warfare. Much of the fighting in Mosul has followed patterns we've seen in other cities. And some of the techniques that have been used on both sides, for example, were used by the Israelis and the Palestinians in Gaza. The problem has been severalfold. It is one that under the previous prime minister of Iraq, he basically took a force which was still in formation, not a mature or combat experienced force, and turned it into a political tool to support his own interest and control over Iraq. You had an extremely weak, corrupt Iraqi army. It was very, very vulnerable to limited pressure from ISIS. You then gave it months, actually more than a year, to dig in many areas. You gradually rebuilt elements of the Iraqi army, but when you look at what happened, it took something like 18 months to get all of the trained and assist personnel forward, and nearly 2 years to get the kind of combat support and the combination of Iraqi forces, fire support from U.S. units, special forces from a variety of countries and air power from a coalition. And then you had to fight step by step in areas which were heavily populated and civilians presented a critical problem. Mm. Now, in a lot of urban warfare in the past, the rule has been you don't care about civilians. They simply die in the process of the fighting. But that's not possible in today's world, and that does slow things down, and it greatly complicates the battle.
Yes, I did read very interestingly that at the start, and I wonder if you could confirm this, the call to civilians was stay where you are, because in the past they've poured out, creating this massive refugee flow, which leads to other problems. And the argument was stay where you are, which has undoubtedly, from what I've read, complicated matters, because there's many, many thousands, tens of thousands still there being used as booby traps and human shields. You know, I wonder, on balance, what's the best way to limit the casualties of civilians? Because either way, they suffer.
Well, that's the problem, and you've asked a critical question. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of the reporting and some of the commentary on this has bordered on the ridiculous. War is a truly horrifying business. If people stay, as we've seen in Syria and other battles in the past, being caught up as civilians in the middle of urban warfare means you get very, very high casualties. If you leave, you have to remember that most people don't become refugees. They become what are called internally displaced persons. But one of the problems you have is that this is war. It is not something where there is a good option. And a lot of the commentary about air power, for example, worries about minimizing civilian casualties on that particular day. But if what you do is slow down the momentum of the battle, you can extend the actual fighting by months, and what appears to be humanitarian on one day can end up tripling, quadrupling the casualties over time.
Mm. So do you think on balance that the Iraqis then, together with a lot of help from special forces, including our own, have they fought well?
I think, again, some have fought very well. You've seen a lot of courage. You've also seen a lot of units that are not particularly well structured or experienced, where the officers don't have combat background, being thrust into intense combat. And again, it hasn't been, in this case, as it was earlier in the fighting, a lack of courage. But the fact is, this is an inexperienced army. It does not have experience in using fire support, which is being provided in addition to special forces by groups like U.S. Marines operating multiple rocket launchers. Until you could put special forces and other advisors forward that really knew how to use air power, very often with the best intentions, Iraqi units were new. The officers were new. The non-commissioned officers were new. They didn't have any experience in this. And the Iraqi air units themselves really didn't have the kind of air power needed to make a major difference. So I think one has to be very careful about talking about this as whether they should be good units. In many cases, they were rapidly formed or reformed. They had to be trained in the rear. It took months to put sufficient advisors and outside fire support forward. It took months to teach people how to use air power efficiently. This isn't something where you simply sit down and decide to be a truly successful soldier. That just doesn't happen.
Still, they look like they're on the point of liberating that city. There must be an enormous symbolic sense of, well, not triumph, but achievement. Civilians are going to be liberated. They've lost their mosque, which was the highest minaret in Iraq, I gather, this leaning minaret. It is a moment, is it not, for the people involved to say, we did it?
I think it certainly is. The fact that they're less experienced units, that they had the courage to persist, that they kept fighting under very, very demanding conditions. I mean, you have two issues here. One is whether these are the most experienced and professional troops in the world, and there are some Iraqi units that have very high standards. The other is what level of courage, persistence, and achievement was involved, and the answer in that case is newly formed units that persist in fighting It is a truly major achievement. One problem we have to also recognize, however, and you've already touched on this, what happens next? Mm. People seem to kind of assume that you drive out the enemy and your problems are over. What's happened very often in urban warfare is you drive out the enemy and your problems have just begun. Your other problem is that Iraq basically has seen, because of a combination of war and a cut in its oil revenues, its poverty figures rise from about 20% of the population in 2014 to about 40%. Mm. And right now you're talking about youth unemployment, where even after several months of recovery in other cities, the figures have been things like 30% unemployment. Well, whether you're in Australia or the United States, all you have to do is think about 30% unemployment to realize just how devastating that can be.
Can I just ask you to finalize, do you believe, as the Russians claim, that al-Baghdadi, the self-styled head of IS or Daesh, do you believe he's dead?
We haven't seen anything come out of the Russians which provides any details as to why they believe he is dead. Now, you've been at war for years. You've been trying to find him for years. Is it possible he's dead? Of course. But do we have cases where people have died five or six times and turned out to still be alive? Unfortunately, that is often the pattern.
Professor Cordesman, I'm sure we'll check in again. It's a very interesting and sobering overview. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Anthony Cordesman from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and keep an eye on the news for that maybe big developments, although put it in context, as he says.